So good morning, everybody. My name is Michael Berger, and I'm the Executive Director of the Sabin Center for Climate Change Law at Columbia Law School. We're an independent center located at the law school that has as our mission to develop innovative legal techniques to combat climate change. So I was asked to come and contribute to this panel by providing a broad overview of environmental law and to talk a bit about how climate change fits into the existing umbrella of environmental law. So I'll talk about that. I'll talk a bit about the Clean Air Act and how EPA has gone about approaching its regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. That will really be the bulk of the talk. And then I'll talk a bit at the end about public health and climate change regulation. So federal environmental law in the United States consists primarily of a slate of statutes that were enacted between 1969 and 1980. There have been a few other legislative activities that occurred between 1980 and 1990, but the last significant piece of environmental legislation in this country was enacted 26 years ago, and was in fact an amendment to the Clean Air Act. It wasn't a new piece of legislation. It was creating the acid rain trading program to deal with that particular problem. Now, these statutes have several characteristics which I think are worth noting. By and large, they are media specific, meaning they take a statute by statute approach to addressing water, air, land, biodiversity. They also reflect a number of different regulatory approaches. So, and they each sort of mix and match in different ways, these different approaches. Some impose technology-based standards. Sometimes they impose harm-based or ambient-based standards. Sometimes they do a risk balancing to come up with the appropriate standard of appropriate environmental pollution. And sometimes, like with NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, they focus on information disclosure. One other characteristic that I think is worth noting is that they are based on state political boundaries and sub-state political boundaries. They are not based on ecological realities, meaning they are not based on watersheds or on airsheds. And second, they're not based on energy infrastructure. So they're not based on the reality of the infrastructure of this country by and large either, which means that states independently regulate energy, which is very important for thinking about how we might approach climate change. So the primary way that we are approaching climate change through law in this country is through the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act is a highly technical and complex statute, and this is one attempt to try and break it down into its core elements. I'll revisit some relevant pieces of this a bit later. But so it takes three different approaches to regulating air pollution. First, it regulates by air pollutant type. So there are the criteria pollutants that Jason referred to before. There are hazardous pollutants, which are regulated under a separate provision of the Act, Section 112. There are quote-unquote other pollutants, which is to date how greenhouse gas emissions are being treated under the statute. And then there's a whole other separate provision of the Act that deals with acid rain, which at the same time is looking at criteria pollutants because they're the same. Second, it regulates by source type. So mobile sources are regulated under Title II of the Clean Air Act. Stationary sources are regulated under other sections. And then finally, it regulates by geography and compliance, and the combination of these two things. States and regions within states can be either in a compliance or non-compliance with relevant statutory standards or regulatory standards. If they're in compliance, then they're called attainment areas. If they're in non-compliance, then they're called non-attainment areas. And different technical standards apply based on those determinations. So what is the pollution problem that we are seeking to address through the Clean Air Act? You saw this before. We are outside the historic range in terms of carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere. What this has led to is we are now also beyond the historic temperature range for the course of human civilization. That red dot at the right end of the first red dot is where we are today, 0.1 degrees C above the Holocene maximum. The 2 degrees C, which is the international target, what the upcoming conference in Paris is aiming to get us towards, is kind of far outside our historic maximum for human civilization. And the actual trajectory that we're on currently, the business as usual trajectory, puts us literally off the chart in terms of global average temperatures. So this is a concern, of course, not just because of the fact of the temperature, but because of the impacts that go along with this. So we have impacts on food and food productivity and food security, impacts on freshwater resources availability and sea level rise, impacts associated with ecosystems and biodiversity, and impacts associated with extreme weather events. And what this chart basically shows is that in each instance, as the temperature, as global warming increases, the impacts get worse and worse. Now, the Clean Air Act is not the best tool that could possibly be available to deal with this problem. It wasn't really created to address climate change. In particular, it's designed for local and regional problems primarily. There is a provision for international air pollution, but it's a single provision that's only been used once before, or even invoked once before, and it wasn't even used. There's no way to directly link mechanisms for pollution reduction under the Clean Air Act with any international mechanisms that might be put in place, such as an international cap and trade greenhouse gas emissions trading program. A couple of the things a little further down that I'd highlight here, it doesn't cover land use changes, and there are no funds for adaptation, there are no funds for mitigation, and there are no funds for low-income relief when addressing the impacts of climate change or the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So it's really not an ideal fit, but the EPA is doing what it can. So in the absence of any federal legislation addressing climate change, there's nonetheless been a good amount of activity. So the U.S. is a member of the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention, and it is a signatory to the Kyoto Protocol of 1997, but the U.S. Senate passed a resolution making very clear that it had that it was opposed to ratification of that protocol. And when George W. Bush took the White House in 2000, he made very clear that he had no intention of addressing climate change. So at that time, a number of states and environmental groups filed a petition with the Environmental Protection Agency asking them to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles, from cars, under Section 202 of the Clean Air Act. So this is a provision that basically, in order to get regulation under the Clean Air Act going, EPA has to make what's called an endangerment finding. What the endangerment finding consists of is a determination that an air pollutant contributes to air pollution which may reasonably be anticipated to endanger public health or welfare. So an air pollutant is defined under the Act as basically an agent or a combination of agents that is emitted into the atmosphere. So EPA determined that they were not going to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles, and they gave two reasons. First, they argued that they didn't have statutory authority to do so. Second, they argued that even if they did have the statutory authority to do so, they weren't going to exercise their discretion because of a number of policy reasons. And just because Paris is a month away, I'll note that one of the policy reasons they offered was that regulating greenhouse gas emissions domestically would interfere with the president's ability to negotiate on the international level. This case made it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court in Mass versus EPA held that greenhouse gas emissions are an air pollutant under the terms of the Act, and that the reasons that EPA gave for not regulating were inadequate. So EPA was then prompted to regulate. They published first a report in 2008 titled Analyses of the Effects of Global Change on Human Health and Welfare and Human Systems. This was a clear signal to Congress that the Obama administration intended to regulate, and just in case they didn't legislate. Federal legislation failed for any number of reasons that are not really worth revisiting at this time, but what wound up happening as a result of that was the Obama administration went ahead and issued an endangerment finding that greenhouse gas emissions cause or contribute to air pollution, which endangers the public health and welfare. So this then triggered a whole set of action, which brings us kind of to today. And so now we have regulations addressing mobile sources, new stationary sources, and existing stationary sources. So after the endangerment finding, the Obama administration ordered EPA and the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration to come up with a national program to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from mobile sources. They did that, and we've had a slate of rules involving fuel efficiency standards for all different categories of vehicles since then. The Clean Air Act's approach to stationary sources divides them the country into states and into regions within states. It then sets emission standards in those regions based on whether they're in attainment or non-attainment. So what it means then to be in attainment is that if you are in attainment, the Clean Air Act requires new or modified sources to go through new source review and to obtain what are called PSD, or Prevention of Significant Deterioration permits. For existing sources, it's a different standard. It's called Best System of Emissions Reductions, and there's a slightly different approach. So in the interest of time, I'll move forward without getting into the complexities of that, but I can answer questions about that later. So EPA says that the tailpipe regulating mobile sources triggers these requirements. So they then go ahead and impose requirements under the PSD permitting provisions. But to do so would require regulating all sorts of very small sources. And here's one of the reasons that the Clean Air Act is not a good fit for greenhouse gas emissions. Regulating from sources, the numeric levels are really set for criteria pollutants, 100 tons or 250 tons per year. Greenhouse gas emissions are emitted at an order of magnitude different. So there was going to be this sort of absurd situation where EPA would be regulating very, very small sources of greenhouse gas emissions under the terms of the Act. So they created what are called the timing and tailoring rules to address that problem. At the same time, they began developing the Clean Power Plan for existing plants. The final rule for that was issued about a week ago. There were a number of court challenges. Everything EPA has done to date on climate change has gone to court, often numerous times. In short, the rules have survived. In UARG versus EPA, there was a distinction that the court made between plants that already fall under the permit provisions. Those can be regulated, and what the court said was that plants that would not already, or sources that would not already require permits, can't be made to be required to have permits. So they sort of sent a signal that they're going to treat greenhouse gases as a different type of pollutant from other pollutants in that case. Now, the Clean Power Plan has been enacted, and there are multiple suits that were filed on the same day that the rule was made final, and those will soon be heard. So I want to talk very briefly about the new source performance standards for greenhouse gases. These were also made final a week ago from this past Friday. These impose different standards on coal-fired plants and natural gas plants. Natural gas plants, basically new natural gas plants, will comply with these standards, so there's not really an issue there. Coal plants, on the other hand, would require carbon capture and sequestration, which is a technology that, though available, is arguably not very economically feasible. So coal plants are not going to be built under this new standard, most likely. Of course, at the same time, nobody's building new coal plants anyway because it doesn't make economic sense given the availability of natural gas. The Clean Power Plan sets targets for states to achieve based on their existing electricity sector. So given electricity production within states, EPA came up with a state target for each of the states, and they built this on three building blocks: improving efficiency at existing coal-fired plants, replacing coal-generation with natural gas-generated generation, and then substituting increased generation from renewable sources, which are zero carbon, for all of the rest. Now, I want to use my last few minutes to just talk a bit about how public health plays a role in what EPA is doing. Public health is obviously at the core of EPA's approach to climate change. It was central to the endangerment finding. In fact, it's the standard on which the endangerment finding was based. And everything that they've done since has been an effort to address some of the public health impacts of climate change. Here are a number of reports that provide some good resources for EPA's view. In short, many of the impacts that Jason talked about in the first presentation can be found also in EPA's analysis. So extreme temperatures, extreme weather, worse air quality produce all of these effects, including increased illness, death due to heat, reduced lung function, water quality is impacted, infectious disease, and then there are indirect effects from extreme events and displacement. Now, the Clean Power Plan, which I think is important for public health professionals, in part because this is an ongoing process. If this rule is upheld, and even before it's upheld, states are undergoing planning processes now to put this rule into effect, to implement this rule. So these are, and all of the ways in which the Clean Power Plan is going to be implemented in the state will have direct public health impacts on individual states. These are the co-benefits that they've identified. Largely, there will be a reduction in conventional air pollutants based on reductions in greenhouse gases. As we move towards a zero carbon or low carbon economy, that will amplify those co-benefits. The Clean Power Plan also includes specific environmental justice provisions, encouraging states to analyze the potential for hotspots, which is a shifting of greenhouse gas emissions to certain power plants, and also promise that they will analyze this in the end. Finally, on adaptation law, there is no federal law on adaptation. There are a number of funding programs that are available and incentives through various planning measures. President Obama's Climate Action Plan is the primary place where adaptation is happening at the federal level, but really state and local laws are the primary drivers of adaptation, and that's the level at which these types of changes are being made. So, thank you very much. Look forward to talking to you later.
Thank you.